Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Dave Deptula, Dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, and welcome to our latest installment of our ongoing Aerospace Nation series. Today, I'm pleased to host a top-notch panel put together with the help of Red 6 to discuss airborne augmented reality and the role innovative technologies can play in addressing the Air Force's pilot training challenges. With that, I'd like to welcome retired General Mike Mobile Holmes, Mr. Robert Otis Winkler, and Mr. Dan Robinson. I'll have a bit more on their background shortly. But first, I'd like to set the scene relative to our topic and why it's so important. Now, everyone out there understands why military training is in crisis today. For many years, the Air Force has failed to produce and retain the number of highly skilled pilots needed to meet our national security requirements. Years of focused senior leader attention and evolutionary change has simply not been up to the challenge of solving the pilot shortage. We're essentially still training our pilots the same way we did 60 years ago. Even as we've seen the emergence of peer competitors, the gap between how we train our combat aviators and how they'll need to fight against modern adversaries has continued to grow wider. The T7 and innovative training processes and technologies from efforts like Pilot Training Next and unit level innovation, they all hold promise for addressing these challenges in part. However, fielding and employing the T7 is going to take many years. Many of the training techniques appearing are immature, and those that are ready must still overcome the reality of an Air Force that, by and large, is pretty risk averse, resistant to change, and on top of all of that, resource constrained. And guess what? Budgets are only likely to become tighter. We've already seen that in the news. So without significant changes to both the way we train our pilots and the technologies we use in pilot training, we'll continue to face shortages and a widening readiness gap. Now, one of the most hopeful technologies that looks to have promise in solving both pilot shortages and the readiness gap is what's known as airborne augmented reality. Less than 2 years ago, flying a real aircraft with or against synthetic rendered aircraft for within visual range training was the stuff of science fiction and movies. But now, one startup has shown that tanking with an augmented reality tanker, flying with an augmented reality wingman, and even flying against an augmented reality bandit controlled by advanced artificial intelligence is not only possible, but it's a reality. As you might imagine, there are obvious implications for how the Air Force should train our pilots. So with that as some context, let me introduce our panelists. First, known to all of you, General Mike Mobile Holmes, recently retired or transitioned, I should say, after a 39-year career in the US Air Force. He last served as the commander of Air Combat Command and guided it during a period of critical change. Post a transition or during transition, he now serves as the chairman of the board for Red 6, a tech startup that fields the world's first augmented reality system that works outdoors to include during airborne training in fighters. Mr. Robert Otis Winkler is probably best known as a professional staff member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, but he also served the US Air Force as a legislative affairs liaison and has extensive experience as an operational director from forward bases to the Pentagon to DARPA. His background in engineering and air power, on top of his legislative chops, make him uniquely qualified to weigh in on this conversation. And finally, Mr. Dan Robinson is the CEO and founder of Red 6. Prior to that, he was a Royal Air Force Tornado pilot and the first non-American to fly the F-22. He spent 3 years flying Raptors with the Air Force before getting his MBA at Georgetown. He worked in finance, and then turning around a UK-based company, an accomplishment that earned him UK Director of the Year honors from the Institute of Directors. So what I'd like to do to kick us off is hand the mic over to General Holmes for some opening thoughts, followed by each of our other speakers. And while you're listening to General Holmes and the others, feel free to raise your hand using the function on the app, submit a question in the Q&A window anytime during the discussion, and we'll get to those questions in the second half of the hour. So with that, Mobile, let me shake the stick and hand it over to you.
Thanks, Dave. And thanks to the Mitchell Institute for bringing us all together with your audience. It's great to virtually see everyone out there. You know, both the Trump administration's national defense strategy and the Biden administration's new national security guidance call on DoD to focus on preparing operators to deter or fight peer threats. And those peer threats are represented by China and Russia. To do so, we're going to have to improve both the quality of the training that we give those operators and the quantity of the training that all operators, and we're talking mostly today about our airmen, receive. You know, the quality of that training is limited by the availability of air and ground training assets that accurately replicate those peer threat systems. And although improvements are being fielded every day, the threats presented at Red Flag for young air crew members resemble 1980s Warsaw Pact threats more than they resemble the capabilities of 2020 China and Russia. Then the quantity of training is limited by the difficulty of maintaining and operating our aging aircraft fleets. And the increasing costs of maintaining those fleets and operating them, and the relentless ops tempo our operators continue to face, combines to limit training opportunities. So we're short both in the quality of training we're giving our operators and the quantity of training. You know, Lieutenant Holmes 40 years ago flew more than 225 training sorties a year, about 350 hours a year. Today, Captain Holmes, flying F-16s in the DC Guard, is lucky to fly 120 of those a year, and almost half of those are flown as Red Air, providing training support for someone else. So the Air Force has worked this hard, but there aren't any magic efficiencies that are going to allow us to take our current training systems and return to flying 225 events a year. So we're running out of our ability to squeeze more efficiency out of the system we have. And so we're going to have to change the way that we approach training. Now, AETC is pursuing developments in our basic pilot training. They started with UPT Next, and they're now flying in UPT 2.5 with the goal of making pilots better and faster. And ACC looked at concepts like rebuilding the forge to try to train experienced fighter pilots better and faster. And I think part of what we recognize and learn is that the future of this new training system will be live, virtual, and constructive. There's still no substitute for live training. If you're going to learn how to max perform an airplane up against the limits of its flight envelope, if you're going to work on the basic skills, if you're going to teach people to perform under risk, if you're going to validate that your aircraft and weapon systems actually work, there's no substitute for continuing live training. But you're going to have to add virtual training because you can overcome the challenges of limited maintenance capability. And virtual training is putting real people together to fight in virtual environments. And you can repeat things over and over. You might get 10 radar presentations in an hour instead of two, you know, in an actual airplane. You can operate at a different security level, so China and Russia aren't watching everything you do. And you can practice things, frankly, in the sim that aren't safe to practice in the airplane. Constructive then adds in AI-driven computer-generated threats so that you can combine those things together. You can bring computer-generated threats either into the virtual environment or into the live environment, and you can work on basic skills, or you can add the components that make large force training hard and expensive. So training pilots better and faster requires a mix of all three. And what I'm excited about doing with Red 6 is that they're working in all three of those areas to make the future real faster. You know, we have to train pilots better and we have to train them faster. And I don't want to steal all of Dan's thunder of exactly how they're doing it, but that's the context that we're operating in.
Very good. Over to you, Otis.
Thanks, sir. And thanks for Mitchell for putting this on. It's such an important topic right at the I think at the right time for the nation to start talking about this. As General Holmes said, LVC or live virtual constructive is widely recognized as the way of the future and the only way, and the only way that's cost effective for us to train against fifth generation adversaries. We spent a ton of money and a ton of time developing the virtual and constructive portion of it. As far as DMO, distributed mission operations across the fleet, so we can link simulators with other simulators through from one side of the nation to the other, or even to Europe and the Pacific. And constructive, we spent an awful lot of time as well, where we're doing virtual red flags out in Ellis and across with the other services. Where we haven't spent an awful lot of time or money is in the live training. And as you articulated earlier, we're training people for like we did the last 60 years. Red flags have been running for 45 plus years, teaching folks how to prepare for those first 5 to 7 days of a war. But they're training against adversaries from around the same time that they started. We tried to upgrade them as best we can, but the span of a fight in a modern battlefield is such that it's very hard to simulate that from a live aspect. So you fight against similar adversaries. You get a lot of the same RF transmissions that are coming up to simulate an adversary from the ground. But what you don't see is when you merge with a fighter or you merge with an adversary, you don't see what the adversary looks like. You don't see how they perform real world. You don't see an S-400 actually launch. You don't see a PL-12 launching when you're 20 miles out getting ready to merge with an adversary. And that's really, to me, that's what augmented reality, airborne augmented reality does. It gives you a cost-effective way to expand the training and to take what Red Flag was initially designed for to the fifth generation, to actually put the pilot in the cockpit, actually flying and having him do mission rehearsals. And I think you can do it from the basic training, as you articulated with new tankers or with augmented reality wingmen, all the way up into mission rehearsal. You know, right before OIF, a good friend of mine got a chance to sit down in a sim that were just coming out in the F-16 and essentially do a mission rehearsal flight for his first three missions in OIF. And he commented that when he actually got there and was flying those first couple of days, it was exactly like it was in the sim. I think everybody that's participated in Red Flag knows that the chaos, the comms, the sensors that you're seeing all mimic what we'd potentially see in a modern day battlefield with major combat operations. But you're not actually in the fight at that point. You're not able to do the mission rehearsal. That's what the simulator gave you 20 years ago. And now augmented reality will allow you to do it in the air to plus up what has happening at a red flag and to give you that real training to prepare our men and women to go forth and win against a modern day adversary. So thanks for doing this.
Very good. Dan, over to you. Tell us about your magic.
Yeah. Thanks, General. Thanks to the Mitchell Institute and thanks to the co-panelists. I really do appreciate your time. Look, Red Six was born, I guess the genesis of Red Six was born during my time on the Raptor. And the reason being is that once I was through the instructor pilot upgrade, if I wasn't teaching, the majority of my time, I guess it would be fair to say, was spent flying Red Air. And the notion that we were flying F-22s to provide Red Air to me was preposterous. It's extremely expensive. There's a huge opportunity cost to the individuals that are flying those sorties when we should be doing what we're ultimately going to be called to do in a combat environment. That's fly Blue Air. Why were we flying those sorties as Red Air? It seemed like such a massive opportunity cost. And I think critically as well, the threats that we are potentially called to go against in the future were the stuff we were able to train against was simply not representative of modern peer adversaries, such as Chinese J-20, for example. So that was really the driving force and the focus of why I started Red Six. And it's the final point on China that I'd like to kind of frame, because whilst we've been involved in counterinsurgency warfare in the Middle East the last 20 to 30 years, there's been a major shift in the global security environment. And I think we're all aware of this. And most pressing of that is obviously the challenge to the United States and its allies from China. I think it's incredibly important to remind ourselves that air dominance is not a preordained or natural right. And every domain now is contested, from air, land, sea, space, and indeed cyberspace. And China are way ahead of us. They've mandated greater integration and joint development of military commercial technology and aligned this to a systematic mobilization of a defense industrial base. And we should be deeply concerned about that. And if we're not, we're wrong. It now appears dangerously close to achieving technical parity, and in some instances, actually technical superiority to the United States. And that represents a crisis to us. And when you align this to some of the asymmetric advantages that China enjoys in the region, so extremely mobile defensive systems, the home court advantage, this poses significant challenges to the US military. So we need to be ready. And if readiness is fundamentally about preparedness for combat, implicit within that statement is that we have the equipment, the technology, and the training to succeed on current and, most importantly of all, future battlefields. And it's this thread I'd like to pull on right now in terms of the lack, Mobile talked about it, but the lack of quality and quantity of training, because despite the Herculean efforts of the aggressors, indigenous red air that we could provide, and of course the private red air contractors, all of which are incredibly important aspects to the solution here, the fundamentals of supply and demand still exist. And I think at max capacity, there still exists somewhere in the region of a 75% demand gap. And if we don't change and we don't do something about it, we are going to lose. So the question is, how do we solve that? And as to Otis and Mobile's point, LVC training is undoubtedly the solution of the future. And I'm going to use LVC or synthetic training interchangeably. But the problem, as I saw with LVC, is that it's only a 50% solution. Why is that? Because it works in the beyond visual range realm. But we all know as combat aviators that the role of a fighter pilot is twofold, right? Out at range, it's a tactician, you're moving your chess pieces around the board. But then as soon as you get within that 10 nautical mile sort of within visual range transition, the role of a fighter pilot changes from tactician to you putting a gun shield in and you're going for a fist fight. And at that point, the LVC training system collapses. Why is that? Because there's no way of visually representing synthetic entities within the visual range of the pilot. Why is that? Because so far, augmented reality hasn't worked outdoors or in dynamic environments. Well, it does now. And so with the technology we've developed at Red 6, we have the opportunity now to offer an entirely synthetic training environment outdoors in the real world to our combat aviators. I'm just going to talk a little bit about augmented reality as an industry, because I think it's worth framing the overall industry as a technology and some of the limitations. Augmented reality is a more nuanced problem than virtual reality. And to level set for the audience, virtual reality will put a headset on, we're in an entirely different virtual world. Augmented reality is a much more complex problem to solve, because we seek to put virtual entities into the real world around us, seamlessly integrated to the real life surroundings. So we get the best of both worlds. We perceive the real world around us, but we get to interact with synthetic entities. But augmented reality as an industry is really in a fairly nascent state. And so far, augmented reality has been an indoor solution only. So I could put a headset on in a living room and show you a pink elephant on the table, but who cares? And it's one of the reasons it's kind of been slow or languished a little bit in comparison to virtual reality. That's not to say we don't think augmented reality is the technology of the future. And I would say that actually, it represents the single biggest inflection point in how we share and interact with our information since computers went to cell phones. But for that to be realized, it has to be ubiquitous in nature. And for it to be ubiquitous in nature, it has to be mobile, which means it has to work outdoors and in dynamic environments. And what we've done at Red 6 is a big stepping stone to enabling the technology to work outdoors and in the most dynamic environments, 300-400 miles an hour at 9 Gs, and the technology is working well. It started by leveraging one of the technologies that the co-founder of the business of Red 6 had actually developed in 2015 in race cars, and that they were the first people to connect two race cars on two separate racetracks, put real race car drivers in them, and connect these race car drivers to a virtual world. And they raced real race cars blind to the outside world. And the moment I saw that technology, I asked two simple questions. Firstly, is that possible in airplanes? And we came back with a yes after a period of thinking. Yes, we thought we could do it. The second question is, could we do that in augmented reality? Because quite obviously, no one is going to allow fighter pilots to fly around in virtual reality. And the answer we got back initially was no. And so over the last 2 to 3 years, we spent a lot of time solving that precise problem to the point where now it is working. So what does this mean? It means we occupy an interesting intersection between live flying and simulation. So we get the best of both worlds. We get our combat aviators to experience the real cognitive loads of flying real airplanes, but we're able to provide synthetic entities as adversary aircraft. And that allows us to replicate near-peer threats. It allows us to provide end numbers, and it allows us to obtain some massive financial offsets. And for all of those reasons, it represents, I think, a new paradigm in what is possible for the provision of red air. The final thing I'll close on is I'd like to say that whilst the genesis of this was to solve the red air training crisis, it became readily apparent that this technology has so much application for the physical production of baby pilots all the way through the ATC pipeline. And ATC have been instrumental in looking at innovative ways to change pilot training through PTN and UP 2.5. I think augmented reality offers an incredibly compelling next step to AETC that will allow us to provide or produce more pilots in a shorter time frame of a higher standard at a dramatically reduced cost. So I'll pause that.
Well, very good. And thank you all for helping lay out the foundation of our discussion. So let's get right into some more details about the use of airborne augmented reality for pilot training. Mobile, can you give us a bit more context on the pilot training challenges that the Air Force is facing and the role that augmented reality might play in solving them?
Sure, Dave. So, you know, the Air Force faces kind of three different challenges within that pilot training shortage or pilot training challenge. The first is just training enough pilots to meet the Air Force's requirements. We took a holiday from training when we had an artificially high ahistorical retention rate in the early days after Desert Storm. And so our pilot cohort is both not big enough and it's also out of balance. We have more older pilots than we need and not as many younger pilots as we need. Within that, there's a shortage in fighter pilots, but within that, there's a shortage in experienced fighter pilots that can lead and teach in squadrons, but can also do the jobs that need to be done on the staff and at our air operations centers. Imagine a world with Red 6 technology where, starting in UPT, where UPT 2.5 is working hard to deliver the content, make the content available to students all the time as part of what they're doing, to use virtual reality to help them learn skills before they get to the airplane. And now with an augmented reality capability, you can bring both of those technologies into the actual airplane. So maybe on one of your early contact rides, you've gone through your acro sequence, you've demonstrated proficiency there, and the instructor dials up a formation wingman and starts to expose that student to formation flying early in the syllabus to give them a chance to see it against a augmented reality partner. Imagine in IFF, if on those early BFM rides, you could throw a Su-27 out there in a 5G turn circle and fly your T-38 around it with augmented reality headsets and be able to see that turn circle and be able to demo to your student what it looks like to go inside the circle and move outside the circle, lead and lag, and teach those concepts in the airplane while they're trying to figure out the buffet rate on the T-38 and make all that work. Imagine then at an operational unit, when I was flying the T-38 as the ACC commander to augment numbers for Raptors at Langley, four Raptors would train against maybe four Raptors and six T-38s. Imagine if those four Raptors could train against maybe four contract red air adversaries and six or more constructive adversaries that would show up in their cockpit and in the visual environment, like Dan talked about, with unpredictability of who they are and where they are and to be able to make all that work. And then imagine in the big airplane world as a bomber pilot, when I'm having trouble lining up tankers to get the tanker training squares that I need to keep my fleet current. If I could call up the tanker overhead Barksdale, climb out after takeoff, do some transition work, go rejoin on that tanker, move in and out with ready lights that actually work and show me if I'm in position. So what I'm doing is creating both efficiencies and sorties. There are sorties I don't have to fly anymore, so I can use more of those for blue air training, and efficiencies that I'm not having to spend a portion of my time flying red air. All my training can be devoted to blue air. So when Lieutenant Holmes was getting 225 sorties a year and about, you know, half of those being red air, now Captain Holmes could get all 100% of his 120 sorties blue air and would start to address that gap that we had in training.
Well, thanks for that. And I think you make a real excellent point. I'm glad to hear you say that, because for too long, some of the programmers up there on the air staff would say, hey, ACC's got their training budget. What they do with it is up to them. Not understanding that, you know, if 40 or 50% of the training is going to red air, that's not an optimal use of butts in those seats, the seats being those fighter aircraft. Anyway, a bit of a follow-up, Mobile. Does the prospect of constrained budgets that we see coming upon us here more rapidly than some of us would like change the way that we should approach pilot training? I mean, I think the obvious answer is yes, but could you tell us a little bit about how?
Yeah, well, Brad Webb and Pulse Wills and their teams, I think, are doing a great job looking at new technologies and how to integrate them into UPT 2.5 while still holding on to the things that are important for training pilots in seats. And I'm looking forward to the results that they're bringing in. But largely what they're doing, again, is that they're making the curriculum available to students all the time so they can study and move at their own rate. They're being able to pre-practice some of those events in a virtual environment. And then they're bringing in AI to measure a student's performance and watch and help the instructor decide what to work on every day. All those things are going to make not just a cheaper pilot, but a better pilot, I think, faster. And then we want to take those same ideas and bring them into the advanced training that happens after UPT. The Thunderbirds now have a virtual reality headset, and before a Thunderbird starts their workup in the airplane, they're able to go fly the syllabus sorties that were filmed with a 360 GoPro, and they're able to sit and watch through and think about what it's going to look like and how the picture looks, where they move and how they do it. And they found that if you do that 6 or 8 times before you fly the sortie, that your performance increases dramatically on that first look, and it jumps you ahead in training. And those are things I think that we can bring in along with bringing into the visual part of the airplane is the AI technology to measure a student's performance and help the instructor decide what's the most effective use of this training sortie that we have today.
Now that's very cogent. And instructive. And as you're talking there, I was thinking back to way back when in 1981, I went through upgrade training as the F-15 aerial demonstration pilot. And I remember my first backseat ride in that demo. And I really had my eyes watered. Actually, I was in the front seat. Yeah. But man, I wish that I wish that you know what you just described existed at that time, to play through and go through what happened, because it certainly would have increased the transition.
Well, and even at a lower stress level, that first trip you took to the tanker, you know, as a lieutenant in the airplane, in the FTUs now, and our flying training units now, before a student goes to the tanker for the first time, we're able again to put them in the virtual reality headset. With the 360 camera made from somebody doing it, they can look around, they can look at the guy on the wingtips, they can look up at the airplane in the boom, and they can get over some of that buck fever of what happens the first time you go.
Yeah, no, that's really impressive. Otis, let's turn to your perspectives here for a minute, because as a staffer on the Senate Armed Services Committee and someone with extensive operational experience as a fighter pilot, can you tell us a bit how movement toward increased use of live, virtual, and constructive training is being viewed on the Hill, and a little bit about what role will airborne augmented reality play within this LVC construct?
Sure. And you know, not speaking for any in particular folks on the Hill, I can tell you that the main focus is we want effective training to make our, in this case, our air crew ready to do what the nation needs them to do. And readiness is of utmost importance. I think widely recognized as one of the most important things that we can give to the men and women that raise their right hand to fight for this country. We can't do that with one red flag trip a year or one trip to the knitter or to one of the, or whether it's up to Alaska you know, and Red Flag Alaska, that's not enough to get people the training that they need. And so they're going to have to do it locally as well. And I really think that the LBC portion is, it helps at Red Flag, but it even more importantly helps in those backyard ranges when they're doing their local training. Whether it's adversaries that they're going to fight against or a ground threat, or even in support of forces on the ground, right? If you can do that from in the simulator prior to going out and flying it live, you get, as General Holmes said, you know, a marked improvement in performance the first time. Just like if you chair fly it, a mission before you go out and fly it live, you're a lot better off. If you can actually fly the mission in the simulator, push freeze, redo the things that you missed, that you made mistakes on, your learning is much faster. What I think augmented reality allows you to do is to take all the benefits of the simulator and move it out into the real world. And so those 120 sorties that Captain Holmes is getting up in the DC Guard, right, he can, every single one of those sorties can be a mission rehearsal sortie that he needs, dialed up to a mission rehearsal sortie that he needs to go win America's wars. If they need to back it down to do more basics, they have the latitude to do that as well. But they can do mission rehearsal up to and including what you'd see out of Red Flag. And then when you go to Red Flag, you definitely can step up your game and have every one of those sorties put a lot more tools back in that toolbox and prepare you to go to war.
Oh, very good. Thank you for that. Now, turn into Dan. As the CEO of a three-year-old startup, you've certainly accomplished a lot. How have you been able to rapidly advance this technology, and what is it that you'd like to see addressed next so advanced technologies can be fielded rapidly?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think as a startup, particularly when you're focused in the tech, into complex technology or advanced technology, you're always operating against a background of capital constraints, right? We don't have any money. Initially, in the early days, we certainly didn't. And so it was absolutely imperative that we clearly articulated the problem that we were trying to solve. And that, I suppose, articulation came from my own background and experience of what it was that really annoyed me and what it was particularly that we wanted to solve. And having identified an acutely defined pain point, that really allowed us to anchor all of our engineering efforts around solving for that very precisely. I think the next aspect to that is really articulating a vision that is bold, that is disruptive, that is challenging, but something that inspires both internal stakeholders and external stakeholders alike. And the vision that we outlined over 3 years ago was to create a future in which all warfighters across all domains were connected together in a joint synthetic training environment. In essence, think of it as a large multiplayer game played outdoors. So a red flag for the joint force, but we can partake in that every day of the week, wherever you are, to Otis's point. And so having articulated that vision, it's absolutely imperative that you align every single ounce of your technical focus towards that vision. And that involves saying no to a lot of opportunities that may at first sight appear to be really shiny and compelling to go chase. But it's imperative as a startup that's moving quickly and has to be agile, that we stay absolutely focused on the vision that we outlined. And so from a technical and operational perspective, we've known exactly what it is that we wanted to solve and exactly how to tackle it. And we've stayed razor focused on doing that and aligned every decision we've taken to achieving the ultimate vision of this joint synthetic training environment. And I've been obviously incredibly lucky to be joined by a fantastic team of, in the early days, the three co-founders. We had such a complementary set of skills across both from the operational perspective and into deep tech it was kind of a unique blend that enabled us to go really quickly with not a lot of resource. I think I'd have to acknowledge the role of the customer in this as well. I think programs such as AFWERX have been incredibly valuable to Red 6, and they were instrumental in guiding us to that early vector through the maze that is the US Air Force. But as the technology has evolved and matured, we've made a very concerted effort to stay closely aligned to the needs that have been articulated by our customer, right? And so it's imperative as a technology company that we're not just developing cool tech in a vacuum, but that we are aligning it to understand the pain points that the customers experience, and that's fundamental to our success. So I think those are really the reasons we've been able to go so quickly. In terms of challenges, what we're doing is technically really challenging, right? We're right at the front and at the, you know, hitting the limits of what augmented reality is capable of doing. And there are a number of technical challenges, but previously there were a lot of unknown unknowns, and those one by one we've ticked them off. So we know how to go do this now, and indeed it is working. So it's just iterating now and getting better and better. But the challenges I'd like to focus on, I guess, are less on the technological and more on the cultural challenges that we face. This technology is coming, and it's coming quickly. It's going to be very, very difficult to stop it. And by its nature, it's a technology that's extremely disruptive, and that's inevitably going to cause a certain amount of discomfort, right? But that's a good thing, because change is uncomfortable. And as I outlined in my opening statement, if we don't change, we are going to lose. So aligned to this change, however, are the realities of fiscal and, I suppose, operational pressures that our warfighters face. Because every day, quite naturally, they are incentivized to deliver operational capability every fiscal year. And so the challenge is, how do we create a culture that allows us to focus on the near-term availability of assets, but also, I suppose, incentivizes a focus on future capability and warfighting advantage over peer adversaries. And that involves exploration of cutting-edge technology such as this. And I suppose key to that is being bold enough to accept some risk and prioritize investments in key technologies such as AR and indeed AI as well. The final thing I'll talk about is dollars as well, because it's imperative that we are aligned from policymakers through every aspect of leadership to understand that for companies coming in that are innovative startup companies, we must be able to support them through the so-called valley of death. And that involves a transition between the allocation of research dollars into O&M dollars. And it's really understanding from top to bottom that it is these technologies that will transform the future force. It's not spending resources on decades old capabilities, making them ready for employment. We need to understand that it's the battlefields of tomorrow that we need to be focused on. And that involves taking key risks in disruptive technologies such as AR, and indeed, I would say AI. And I think as an overall challenge, it's that culture of innovation from within the service and up on the hill that I'd encourage really to get behind this.
Yeah, well, that's always been the challenge, is the cultural one, as everyone on this panel, and I'm sure many in the audience realize, technology, as you said, Dan, isn't necessarily the limiting factor. It's a culture. And Otis, I'm sure you would agree with that coming from your position. You don't have to say anything. We all know what it's like. Dan, expanding upon your perspective, you know, you're really one of only a few people in the world who've flown against augmented reality bandits controlled by AI. Can you tell us a little bit just what that's like? And you mentioned a little bit of it, but where do you see the combination of augmented reality and artificial intelligence going in the future?
Yeah, it's a really important question. I think to the first part of the question, what is it like to have flown against an augmented reality bandit driven by AI? Well, let me describe exactly to the audience what that means. We are taking off in our own test airplane at Red 6. We're going up into the sky, and we are meeting a augmented reality Chinese J-20 that is controlled and is acting autonomously by AI. And so one of the questions that we're often asked is, how do we control these entities? And really there's three ways of controlling them, right? There's the scripted way in terms of giving ourselves pictures such as offensive 6K setups that we're, you know, the way we'd always train fighter pilots through the basic building blocks of BFM. There is virtually, so the ability to control the AR avatar on the ground. So imagine a pilot in the ground in a virtual reality headset, flying an avatar up in the sky against a real airplane, and the pilot in the real airplane sees that avatar and is fighting his buddy on the ground. So that's virtually. And I suppose the panacea is ultimately where the core of the question lies, is ultimately, it is driven by artificial intelligence. And so when I go up there, you know, we're engaging in a BFM scenario against a Chinese J-20 that we're seeing that is thinking and flying and acting and making BFM decisions as it would be as if it was a real pilot. And it's flying its best BFM against us. That's to say it understands lead, lag, aspect, closure, heading crossing angle, energy management, both potential and kinetic. And it is something to behold. It's really pretty incredible to see. And what that means is this technology is not a vision of the future. This is here right now and it's working. It's incredibly exciting, but the second part of the question on AI, I think this represents the first step towards the broader adoption of AI and AR. And currently we're working with a commercial partner that's a part of the Alpha Dogfire trials with DARPA to validate a tactical AI design architecture that is using deep reinforcement learning. But because we're able to use it with augmented reality to represent it in the real world, we're actually taking those algorithms outside of the simulated world. And this allows us to validate some really important lessons of trust and safety whilst building a data set, which I think is absolutely unique in the world and extremely valuable in terms of real pilots and real airplanes flying against this AI in the sky, up in the sky, sorry. Ultimately, I suppose I see a combination of AR and AI expanding throughout the industry to make sure that the overall concept of tactical automation and programs such as Law Wingman ultimately become a reality. And I think that AR represents an incredibly interesting way for human beings to train and interact with the AI and continue that iteration and learning. Because ultimately it's about these data sets that we're building. And if we can help AI evolve through sophisticated human machine interface, then this has the opportunity to expand into LFE training and even campaign level modeling. And AR is a really core enabler to validate that AI. I think the final thing I'd say is that the level of simulation and validation is a continuous feedback loop that allows us to make better decisions faster. And what we're ultimately talking about is being able to get inside the enemy's OODA loop, right? So this has direct crossover, not just from the world of training, but into operational programs such as ABMS and JADC2. And it's something that our competitors, particularly the Chinese, are taking incredibly serious. The idea that they can model, iterate, understand lessons learned, feed that back into AI and evolve is making their decision-making faster and faster. And we need to do the same, and we need to do it better than they are. So it's an incredibly interesting way to validate AI. And I think it's obviously incredibly cost-effective to do it as well.
And that's great. And it's also an area where you can see the results of the application of AI and measure their effectiveness very quickly. And that's important too. Just real quick, are you working with DARPA or just capitalizing on the work that they're doing?
Red 6, we're not working directly with DARPA, but we are, I suppose, working with them through one of the companies that's involved in the Alpha Dogfire trials, and that we're taking the AI algorithms that they're producing and we're actually validating them up in the air. So cool. We're building an incredibly important data set there. It's working incredibly well.
Very good. Now, Otis, in terms of joint training, what do you see as the role for airborne augmented reality and its offshoots in the other domains? And do you think the technology will have implications for our ability to train with our allies as well?
So absolutely. You know, pivoting off of what Dan was saying, we've been talking a lot about training and augmented reality and training. And I think examples like Skyborg and the efforts that the Air Force are doing to provide red air and augmented red air will really make a difference and provide a cost-effective solution and provide game-changing benefits in the training environment. But when you think about it, the Joint Force writ large has been doing augmented reality for the last 20 years, whether it's JHEMEX, whether it's IVAS in the Army, the idea that we can project information out into this span of what we're looking at while we're fighting is something that has changed the game in warfighting. And I think that our ability to do that in the fight throughout the Joint Force is another added benefit of the airborne augmented reality. You can picture a JTAC on the ground looking up and trying to get controls in a training environment and seeing an augmented reality aircraft that he can provide his normal procedural controls for and to get all of his training squares. But you can also see that in a in combat where he's able to look up and actually see the entire the combined operational picture through his goggles as he spans the horizon, and he could see what the ordnance and the fuel remaining. He could reach out and touch each individual aircraft and pull the aircraft that may be best suited for him. And so for the joint fight, I think it will pay off huge dividends as well as in training when we're integrating with the joint force. You know, normally if you go out and you're providing close air support, there's a JTAC on the ground, there's a target, he talks you onto the target, and then you expend your ordnance, which is difficult in and of itself. But using augmented reality, you could turn that range into a modern battlefield that you can have obscuration, you can actually see troops on the ground moving to contact. And again, just like we talked about in Red Flag, as a joint force, we'll become better when we take and we put a warfighter, regardless of the domain, into the scenario, live scenario, using the equipment that they're going to use in combat and letting them experience that.
Very good. Thanks for that. Mobile, really quickly as we wrap up here and move to audience questions, your work on the fundamental pilot training challenges that are facing Air Combat Command and the Air Force has really given a new sense of urgency to a problem, and one that it doesn't appear to have a single bullet solution. What are your thoughts on how you hope the Air Force will move forward?
Well, thanks, Dave. You know, I think this is one of those areas that our Chief of Staff, General Brown, would say we have to accelerate or lose. And, you know, there's, you know, the old joke about amateurs think about tactics and professionals focus on logistics. Service eights like me, guys that work programs, say, you know, amateurs focus on ideas and professionals figure out how to pay for them. The next step here, I think, is to get money into the advanced pilot training program element to go see what's possible in advanced pilot training, bringing in augmented reality. It's to set up a program element for a reforge-like concept so we can figure out the best use of the T-7 in the time that we have before we start to deploy it in numbers. And then I think probably pick out one of our legacy kind of fighter platforms to bring augmented reality into that airplane to see what it provides in the training environment and move from small business innovation research funded contracts into programs of record with a program element monitor and somebody who's charged with going forward. And it's not just the Air Force, right? It's the Air Force, OSD, the Office of Management and Budget, and then OTIS and our friends on the Hill that have the ultimate decision about how we spend our money. It's going to take teamwork among those four elements to go move out and accelerate change.
Very good. Well, thank you all for your comments on this fascinating issue. And on behalf of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, we wish you all the best in your endeavors in accomplishing your objectives. Now, before we move to questions real quick, I'd like to remind our listeners that our next event is day after tomorrow, Thursday, March 18th, when we'll be hosting Lieutenant Colonel Mike Benitez in the next edition of our Aerospace Nation series. All right, while we're waiting for hands, I've got two chat questions from Chris Franklin. First one, are there ways to have low enough latency to have countries thousands of miles away to train together? This kind of is a follow-up to a question to Otis about training with our partners, international partners. And then the second one is a little more technical, but I'll throw it out there now and then you all can decide who wants to answer what. This is from Chris too. What are the technical challenges associated with moving from parabolic lenses to projecting on the whole visor, like on the F-35 helmet? So over to you guys.
You know, I think Dan should probably take on both of those. Both latency and the visor challenges are things that Red 6 is working.
Yeah, thanks. They're actually great questions. So the first one on latency, I think the initial, when we first founded Red Six, the aspiration, the idea was, look, we don't just want to create a solution here across the joint force, but wouldn't it be fantastic if we could connect allied nations simultaneously into an airborne augmented solution. So envision an F-22 taking off at Langley Air Force Base whilst a Eurofighter takes off at RAF Coningsby in the UK. They both head out to their airspace, and then they go in, they step into this environment where they meet each other in the airspace, and they can either train against each other or they can train alongside each other. And that was the vision for what we wanted to solve. Now, clearly there's one rule that is kind of a big rule, and that's the speed of light. So the speed of light is obviously difficult to overcome, but there are ways around that. So I would point you to games, big multiplayer games that exist globally, like such as Fortnite. And there are a number of techniques that could be employed, such as pose estimation and predictive analysis as to where movements come. And they're doing those in multiplayer games where the movements are much more nuanced and rapid. So for example, a soldier crouching behind a desk, and of course they do that successfully. What we're talking about is fighter combat, where the predictive ability of the realities of the physical limitations of the airplane are a little more predictive. So it's not like an airplane is going to snatch instantaneously and vanish 2 meters to the left or to the right. We're talking about predictive turn circles and flight envelopes that we understand. So whilst it's a little way off, it's something that we're absolutely aiming towards. The second point on the display technology, there are some fundamental limitations to current incumbent technologies that we use in helmets, such as the F-35 helmets and helmet mounted cue systems, and those are retained to waveguides. And the problem with waveguides is it's very difficult to bend them. So you have a limited field of view. You could theoretically have a waveguide that is this wide and will give you a huge field of view, but to put them onto curved surfaces is very difficult. And then there's also a potent cocktail of brightness, resolution, all of the things you have to overcome. And I think stepping away from technologies such as waveguides and more towards the use of true holographics is probably the way that we're going to have to go in the future to solve that. And that's an interesting industry in itself, with only a real few experts in that field that are capable of doing it. So some interesting technical challenges, but I will say that there are companies out there that are working precisely on those very things.
Very good. Let's switch to our live panelists or audience and Valerie and Senna from Defense News.
Hi, thank you all for doing this. I have a question for Otis. I was wondering, what questions and concerns do lawmakers have about using augmented reality for training? And what do you think they need to see from the Air Force and from industry in order to get the buy-in that's necessary for rolling these sorts of solutions out, you know, in a broad and comprehensive way?
Sure. So I think what the second part of your question, right, is that what people need to see writ large is proof, right? It moving from a PowerPoint presentation off to at least a basic proof of concept to be able to get this done. I think that is out there, right? There are examples of this, like we talked about in the earlier, augmented reality is been a part of a heads-up display, Jehemix, and I've asked for a long period of time. Moving it into a training environment where you're actually projecting images that aren't necessarily there is something that we're going to have to prove to folks as far as latency, as far as the ability to make a difference in training. But I think when people actually experience this, it becomes hard to argue with. I mean, if you look at what our kids are doing when it comes to augmented reality and in the video games that they're playing, that's kind of the expectation when folks show up in the military. And I think most of them are disappointed. I know the people I talk to are disappointed when they go out and say, this isn't exactly what I thought it was going to be like. You're still doing, you don't even have glass cockpits, right? You're still dealing with 1980s technology. And our ability to use augmented reality across the board, right, and to leverage it in training and in operations, I think is something that is easily explained based on the current culture that we have. We just have to actually go do it.
Okay, very good. How about Mike Boera?
Hey, thanks, Dave. Appreciate it. And I appreciate this whole discussion. I'll say, so for the audience, I'm Mike Boyer from Leidos. I'm the Air Force Strategic Account Executive. Daniel, great to hear you again. You were at the multi-domain C2 AFWERX Fusion event, and I was very impressed with what you were talking on stage. Otis, always a pleasure to work with you. But this question is for mobile. Given your time now on the outside, out of uniform, and with augmented reality in mind, and the vested interest that you have, like I have, with Suns flying fighters today, has your perspective changed at all from the seat you were in at Langley to where you are today, and what you've learned from Daniel or industry on the outside? Anything changed from your time in uniform? Thanks, and great seeing you all again.
Yeah, thanks, Bo. I think the biggest thing that, and Bo and I are pilot training classmates, by the way, 8208 at Columbus. I think the biggest thing I see on the outside is how hard it is to take a good idea that warfighters want and work it through the bureaucracy and get it to warfighters. And I don't mean bureaucracy in a bad way, but you know, there's a report out published in the last couple of weeks that talks about how we're going to have to change our programming system to be able to go faster. That I think is absolutely necessary. And I think we are going to have to work together as a team, both the people still wearing the uniform and the people still working in civil service and people on the Hill and the industry, to try to figure out together how we're going to go faster. I mean, I'm working with Red Six. I'm working with the Roosevelt Group. I'm working with several other companies. And what I'm trying to do is work in that space to help people with good ideas that warfighters need, navigate the process so that warfighters can get them in less than the 20-year period that's kind of proven out by legacy. And I think I see firsthand the problems that they face, and I'd like to work on that.
Okay, let's take another one from our live audience. We got a bunch of really good ones on chat. Rick Hunter. Hey, Rick, we're not hearing you. We'll check your system and we'll come back to you. Let's go over to Oriana.
Hi, all. Thanks for doing this. I know we chatted recently as early as this month, but since that time, I know that Dr. Will Roper joined your board at Red Six. Could you talk a little bit about his role at the company and if he will be reaching out to industry to try to flourish the company a little bit more, or what is his role?
So thanks for the question. Will Roper has joined us. He's actually joined the advisory board, not the main board of the company. And he is there to offer an absolutely unique perspective. I think it will be less around Dr. Roper reaching out directly to industry, and certainly not to the Air Force, more offering the insight and expertise that he is renowned for. And I will tell you that he's already added a tremendous amount of value just in terms of the interactions I've had with him. I can't speak highly enough to his thinking, the way he looks at problems in a fundamentally different way. And he's certainly challenged some of my preconceived notions as to how we should go about approaching Red Six and approaching this technology. So he's an advisor. He's not on the main board, but he's incredibly valuable and has proven to be so already.
Okay, thanks for that. Rick, are you able to fix your mic problems?
I think so. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you loud and clear now.
Okay, very good, very good. My question is, it deals with debriefing in the LVC environment. I had some 13 red flags in the F-15C and program manager for contracted aircrew training at Air Combat Command for a number of years. And we were fielding the mission training centers at that time. I just can't imagine how you debrief in that constructed environment at a red flag. Could somebody illuminate on that?
Dave, I'll take that one, Rick. It's a great question, and actually something that we're very busy working on right now inside of Red Six, because obviously without debriefing the data, then there's a little point in going to fly the sortie. But the system we're working on actually is enables us to fully reconstruct what we've just been up there and done. So I go up there, I fly against a J-20 in a real airplane. I'm flying against an augmented reality J-20. I can come down and take that data and analyze it in ways, without going into too much detail right now, but in ways that have never been done before, because it is absolutely imperative that we take the lessons learned so we can do all of the root cause analysis that we know and love, and is such an important part of the debrief. But leveraging the technologies such as AR and VR and AI and gathering the data enables us to get an insight into some of the decision-making that pilots make on a daily basis that we haven't had before. So I would stress to you that the debriefing technology is coming in line with the augmented reality technology in the airborne environment, and it's going to be just as important, if not more important, and will usher in a new fidelity and a new capability in the level of analysis that we're able to do in the debrief.
Hey, Rick, I'll jump in there real quick. You know that ACMI, the Air Combat Maneuvering Instrumentation Range environment that we grew up in at Red Flag, one way to think of that is as a gaming environment. It keeps track of all the players in the game, but it only tracked the live players. As you go forward with LVC training, that gaming environment has to expand to track the live and the constructive. And then, as Dan said, you're able to bring back more information because of what you're doing in the cockpit of the live players and what you're doing in the constructive cockpit. You're able to bring actually more information back that lets you know not just what the airplane was doing, but what the people inside were doing and where they were focusing their effort, that I think offers us a way to debrief better. So it's expanding that gaming environment like Fortnite or like one of the other ones, to where you're keeping track of both the live players and the constructive or virtual players.
Hey guys, we've come up on our time, but there's really two more questions I'd like to squeeze in here. So if you have about three or four more minutes, let me hit you up with these. First one here is from Ted Kresge, Kmart. Is there a role for a flying simulator? In other words, taking a T7 and perhaps installing HOTAS displays and simulations so that it functions like an F-35. This would allow less expensive FTU and possibly a companion trainer for ops units. What are your thoughts?
I'll go first and I'll let Dan go. But the short version of that is that's what you're trying to do in Reforge. That's what the Israelis do in their fighter pilot academy, is that their Leonardo has constructive avionics where it simulates a radar warning receiver, an advanced targeting pod, and puts those together with the data link between the airplanes. And so it's kind of a flying simulator. It's not too big a leap to think that you could then change the displays to make it look like the displays of an F-35 or an F-22 or an F-15 or an F-16, so that your Reforged students were training in that airplane or what looks like the airplane. They're going to go fly at a cheaper rate, and then they go through a short transition course and move over into the other airplane.
Yeah. Dan, anything to add?
Yeah, sorry. The only thing I would add is actually that technology exists already. And I actually just saw something online this week that was a demonstration of that, precisely that in the virtual world. And it's not beyond the wit of man to think that that's doable up in the air as well. So I think that technology is actually a little closer than you might expect.
Okay, very cool. Here's one from Kurt Detmer for Dan. The number one killer in aircraft accidents is spatial disorientation, which is hard to simulate in a sim. Does this Red 6 approach, where the student is actually flying, finally solve this issue?
Yes, it's a great question. And it's the core of why I'm so passionate about what we've developed, because my contention was, simulators have a really important role to play, but there's no way that we can emulate the kind of cognitive loads or spatial or risks associated with flying real airplanes. And the beauty of augmented reality now, or airborne augmented reality, is that we get the best of both worlds, right? We get to go up, we get to fly airplanes, we get to experience G-forces running out of fuel, or the ability to crash into the ground and get spatially deed. But we get to do that whilst being extremely cost-effective and getting peer-level threat training, because we can simulate adversaries. I would say that obviously through the test and evolution of this technology, that safety has been at the forefront of what we're doing, because spatial D was, of course, a paramount concern. But I can tell you it's largely transparent. It's simply, you are looking out of the cockpit as you would always, And rather than see a real airplane now, you just see a synthetic airplane. So it's actually pretty intuitive when you go do it for real. And it was something that we were concerned about initially, but honestly, it's not a factor.
Okay, I said two, but I've got to add one more from Evan Byron. And it's a bit of a philosophical question, but it's a really pertinent one. Here's what Evan asks. How do we address the people in the Department of Defense and Congress who do not understand the technologies needed for the future or warfare, which inhibits the ability to integrate them into the services?
Real quick for me, there may be some not understanding, but I think, you know, we have people like Otis up there, and there are people up there that do understand a lot of the problems. I think it's less the understanding as it is hitting the I believe button that we can make those technologies work and that we can produce them on time and on budget and get them out there to the warfighters. Otis?
Yes, sir, I agree. I mean, the advocacy, I don't think, is nearly the problem as the proof. And so actually getting the proof and actually doing it, it will go a long way. And then I think it's hard to argue with, quite frankly.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of this Aerospace Nation event. It's been fascinating. I really appreciate all of you. And thanks to General Holmes, Mr. Winkler, and Mr. Robinson, to you and to our audience from all of us at the Mitchell Institute. Have a great Aerospace Power Counter Day.